Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
The Harper government has introduced sweeping reforms to Canada's Elections Act. How will this change future votes, and how is the government responding to mounting criticism? The Minister of State for Democratic Reform, Pierre Poilievre, is here to weigh in.
In just days, we'll get our eyes on the new fiscal plan from the Federal Finance Minister. With what to expect in Budget 2014, we're joined by former Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page and the Minister of State for Finance, Kevin Sorensen.
The first charges have been laid in the Senate expense scandal, while Senate Liberals adjust to life after being booted from the National Caucus by Leader Justin Trudeau. The leader of the Grits in the upper chamber, James Cowan, joins us.
And then a scandal of a different variety. Toronto Star reporter Robin Doolittle is here to talk about Mayor Rob Ford and her new book, Crazy Town.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. On Tuesday, the Harper government finally unveiled its proposed legislation to reform the Canada Elections Act. The reforms will increase the personal donation limit to $1,500, make it illegal to impersonate election officials, and it would create a robocall registry. But what's caused the most controversy is the change at the top. The commissioner who's in charge of investigations will be moved out of Elections Canada and sit independently. On top of that, there is a fear of government muzzling. Officials are being restricted from talking about their investigations, and they can't even encourage Canadians to go out and vote, only tell them when and where to cast a ballot.
The Minister of State for Democratic Reform, Pierre Poilievre, believes these changes are necessary because, as he puts it, the referee should not be wearing a team jersey. Speaking to reporters this week, Chief Electoral Officer Mark Mayran quibbled with Mr. Poilievre's analogy.
Listen, the only jersey that I think I'm wearing, if we have to carry the analogy, or whatever, I believe is the one with the stripes, white and black. Okay. What I know from this bill is that no longer will the referee be on the ice.
McLean's political editor Paul Wells had a chance to sit down with the Minister of State for Democratic Reform.
I want to give you a chance to give me your elevator pitch for this bill. It's a complex bill. It does a lot of things, but how will it improve Canadian elections in a nutshell?
Well, it keeps Canadians in charge of democracy by pushing special interests to the sidelines and rule breakers out of business. So what does that mean? Well, one, it closes loopholes to big money. The most obvious example of that is that we're banning the use of loans to evade donation limits. While that's already illegal, we want to ensure that the illegality is met with firm penalties that can be enforced. So it does that. Secondly, it combats voter fraud by removing some of the most unsecure forms of voter identification that are allowed, namely vouching and the voter information cards. And three, it brings new offenses and penalties for political imposters who make illegal or rogue calls. It also forms a mandatory registry so that we can track those calls when they happen and investigate them more thoroughly afterwards. On the other side, though, I think the bill will make democracy more accessible by adding in a new advance polling day. There's already 2 million Canadians who voted in advance in the last election. They'll have one more day with which to do it. We're going to reduce congestion at the polling stations so it's a quicker process, and require Elections Canada to actually focus its advertising on the basics of voting, where, when, and what ID to bring.
A lot of the early controversy has been around process. You're in quite a hurry with this bill. First reading the morning after, or the second reading, first debate the morning after it was tabled. Time allocation almost immediately. Why the rush?
Well, there will have been almost a week passed when the bill is actually voted for the first time, and on Monday, and there will be a thorough study of the bill. I expect there will be a lot of witnesses on both those who are in favor and those against, and necessary amendments will be considered. And then, of course, there'll be another whole round of debate in the House of Commons once it's reported back from committee.
Are you willing to consider substantive amendments or only drafting amendments?
I think the fundamentals of the bill are set in place, but if there are some good ideas on how those fundamentals can be better implemented, then we always consider amendments.
An earlier version of this bill came within a day of being tabled nearly a year ago by your predecessor, Tim Upple. It was pulled very much at the last moment, and it's reported to have been pulled because of concerns raised by the Conservative caucus. What's changed since then?
Well, I can't comment on discussions that happened in caucus, but I can say that Tim Upple, the foreign minister, did a terrific job preparing a legislative proposal without revealing any confidences. His work is all over the evidence of his work is all over the Fair Elections Act. He is to be thanked for many of the measures that are contained in it. I think I was lucky to have a little bit more time than he had, and as a result, we were able to take the bill from where he left it over the finish line.
And to bundle a couple of different criticisms of the bill from the opposition and from some of my colleagues together, they tend to go in the direction of worry that it'll be harder to vote. One of them is the notion of vouching, the idea that if I don't have the proper identification, I can bring a friend who will assert that I am who I claim to be before I vote. That's going to be banned. Some of the irregularities that have been reported around vouching seem to be relatively trivial. And the effect of this seems to be that a lot of people won't be able to vote who could in previous elections.
Well, I think we should be careful to suggest triviality around the problems that associate with vouching. Let me give you first the overall fact is that 25% of cases where vouching is used, there are irregularities. The Supreme Court, in its decision on OPITS, said that these are very serious irregularities, and the earlier court judgment did likewise. The Neufeld report, commissioned by Elections Canada, also said that these kinds of irregularities could lead to a lack of voter confidence in the electoral system. So those who have looked at controversies around vouching and issued findings on them have concluded that they're not trivial matters. They're very serious.
The other concern is the idea that Elections Canada, which has been in the business of urging Canadians to get out and vote, will no longer be permitted to do so. Why not?
What we're focusing the Elections Canada's promotional campaigns on the practical information people need to cast a ballot. First among those is that group are where, when, and what ID to bring. But also, we want people to know about the other opportunities to vote. There are three main opportunities that you can vote before Election Day even comes. That's the advance, by mail, or by voting at the Elections Canada office. 50% of people under the age of 24 did not even know that those opportunities exist. So if they are students and they're busy on Election Day, they just don't vote right now. So I think Elections Canada needs to do a better job informing that cohort of the opportunities they have to vote. Among Aboriginal youth, it's 73% that are unaware of the three advanced voting opportunities that are available to them. Frankly, I don't blame them for not knowing. The advertising is not focused on these practical matters, and it should be. I should also note that Elections Canada's own data shows that 60% of people who did not vote said that everyday issues prevented them from casting a ballot. So it wasn't that they needed to see an inspiring advertisement from Elections Canada. It's that they were too busy, they were traveling, they had family obligations. So I think if that 60% had information about, advanced voting, if they had information about where they cast their ballot, they would be more inclined to do so. A lot of people don't get voter information cards because of mistakes in the National Registrar of Electors, and often those cards go missing. So if you come home and you're a single mother who's worked hard all day, it's now 7 o'clock, you kind of know that the election is happening that day, but you're in a time crunch, and you're trying to decide whether you're going to squeeze voting in. You don't have the information at your fingertips, you might not go and cast the ballot, and understandably so. That's why Elections Canada needs to focus all of its advertising resources on making sure people like that have the practical information necessary to cast the ballot.
I hear from some commentators, some observers, who say that the problem is not that Elections Canada is no good at marketing voting, but that they're really good at marketing and they're doing it to a selected audience. They're only marketing among people who might be likelier to vote Liberal and leaving out clientele groups that might be likelier to vote Conservative. Is that a concern of yours?
No, that's not. That has nothing to do with the issue. In fact, they're really doing a really. If you look at the data, the cohorts that people talk about are actually not turning out in very high numbers. Young voters, for example, our youth voter turnout has declined, and its decline actually happened right at the time that Elections Canada's promotional campaigns came into effect. There's a part. Well, the Parliament of Canada did a study, for which I can furnish you the link, that showed between 1984 and 2000, voter turnout among youth dropped by 20 percentage points. Elections Canada began its promotional campaigns in 1993. So right in the middle of that study, you see Elections Canada's targeted promotional campaigns introduced, and the results are the opposite of what is expected. Now, what I would say is this. I'm not suggesting that Elections Canada's ads are driving voter turnout down. I'm saying they're failing to drive it up. And the reason that they're failing is because they do not focus on the practical tool, the practical nuts and bolts that voters require to drop a ballot in the box.
At the current clip, this bill seems likely to be passed relatively soon. Does that clear your agenda, or what's next for a Democratic Reform Minister after a new Elections Act?
Our friends at the Supreme Court will tell us. I mean, they're going to come back with the findings on our senatorial proposals and the constitutionality of them. We expect they'll give us a legal instruction manual on how the Senate can either be elected or abolished. When we have those findings, we'll have the issue of Senate reform back on the agenda.
Maclean's political editor Paul Wells with Minister of State for Democratic Reform, Pierre Poilievre.
Coming up on the show, we take a look at what may or may not be in Budget 2014. The leader of the Senate Liberals sits down to talk about the future of his caucus. And we speak with Toronto Star reporter Robin Doolittle about Mayor Rob Ford.
On Tuesday, Canadians will finally get their eyes on the fiscal plan of the Conservative government.
Finance Minister Jim Flaherty has purchased his traditional new pair of shoes before unveiling Budget 2014. And at the photo op, he dismissed rumors he may be able to balance the books this year instead of 2015, as is his plan. With a preview of this year's budget, I'm now joined by the Minister of State for Finance, Kevin Sorensen. Thanks for joining us.
Cormac, it's my pleasure.
I guess my first question is, what can Canadians expect from this budget?
Well, I think, Cormac, that most Canadians understand that this budget is going to be part of a overall plan that we've really addressed over the last number of budgets. We've said that we are going to move towards a balanced budget in 2015, that we are going to make certain that we keep the economy as the improving the economy is the number one goal, and we help with job creation and skill development. And so I think as we move towards Tuesday and towards Minister Flaherty standing in the House of Commons and bringing down the budget speech, the Canadians understand that those will continue to be the priorities of our government.
So on specific measures that may be brought forward in the budget, I guess one question that will be on the mind of many Canadians is, will there be any consumer-friendly measures?
Well, we've had a history of standing up for families and consumers. I think that we can expect more action on the consumer agenda. Certainly, we made an announcement in the speech from the throne that we were going to announce, this consumer agenda. And so as we approach the budget, we've had the appetizer with the speech from the throne. I think more of the main course will be given in the budget.
Last year, we saw several import tariffs get cut and then many more actually increase. Will there be any movement on import tariffs in this budget?
You're going to have to wait till Tuesday for more of the specifics, Cormac. I think, Minister Flaherty will unfold that. I don't think there will be any big surprises. Again, we are a government that has shown that we want to keep taxes low. That includes tariffs. So we don't want to see the prices for Canadians go up. And we want to make sure that families have an easier time after the budget raising their their family and raising their children than they did before.
All right, now there are two words that often pop up every time we get into budget season, and it's spending and cuts. So will there be any new spending that we'll see, or in your mission to balance the books, will we be seeing more cuts than new spending in this budget?
We've made some very key investments over the last number of years, especially going into the downturn. We have said that we wanted to invest in long-term infrastructure and we want to help municipalities and provinces and work together in partnerships with them to make certain that the infrastructure for building an economy and building prosperity is in place. So that's been the history. I don't think we're going to move away from that plan. I think when you see the budget announced that it'll be positive as far as infrastructure and positive as far as that type of investment.
The Conservative government introduced the jobs grant last year, and we still haven't seen it put in place. There are some issues to work out with the provinces because the provinces rejected that. Can we see any fixes in this budget for the jobs grant program?
Well, right now, Minister Kenny is working with the provinces. They are in negotiations, and I think I give the provinces credit. I know that our minister is taken with this. We want to see Canadians all ages working, and we want to see Canadians prospering. And we believe that an important part to that prospering is a job. We believe that enhancing skills is a very, very important part for the labor force.
Why bring this down during the Olympics? Normally, the budget is brought down in March, not in February. The Olympics are on right now. Canadians' attentions will be diverted towards what's going on in Russia and not so much on the budget. Was that a part of the strategy to bring this budget down, as some have suggested, that because you're not going to have as many goodies this year as you will next year, that you wanted the spotlight sort of taken off the budget?
Not at all. In fact, we would encourage all to watch this budget. We're focused on the economy. The Olympics never once entered into any of the discussions that we had as far as rolling out this budget.
All right. And the last question I have for you is the most important one of them all. Will you be buying a new pair of shoes for Budget Day as well?
Typically, the minister who delivers the budget speech goes out and purchases a new pair of shoes. If it was my wife, she would have a new pair of shoes. I'm probably going to stay with the same shoes I have. I know Minister Flaherty is more of a traditionalist, and he'll have new shoes. Thanks for bringing that up. It's the first I've really even considered it, so we'll have to see.
Kevin Sorensen, Minister of State for Finance, thank you so much for joining us today.
You know what? It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
I was able to speak with former Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page, who is now holder of the Jean-Luc Pepin Research Chair at the University of Ottawa. Page and I got a little bit more in-depth on the government's fiscal plan.
There's some suggestion, I think the idea going into this budget, or some of the expectation going into this budget, is that it's going to be a fairly unremarkable budget, a fairly sort of stay-the-course budget. Does that mean that there won't be anything sort of interesting about what the government reveals next week?
Well, I think that is the expectation. But I think, for somebody like me that's worked at the central agencies, the first thing I will do to kind of sense what's in the budget, and we just had a recent speech from the throne, so I'll go back to that October speech from the throne, and I'll make my list of things, like what is in there, and did that speech from the throne really signal new programs? Or potentially new changes to regulation? Is there a strategy? And then, so that'll give you, I think it'll give Canadians and most people, like in a pre-budget context, what we can expect. Because I know from somebody who worked at the Privy Council office, and when we'd be working with finance or the finance minister, the prime minister, we'd be trying to tick off all those boxes. Are we delivering on those commitments in the speech from the throne? And so, just from that, we know, I think on the economic and fiscal side, that speech from the throne started right from the top about reducing the cost of government. And so we know I'm anticipating balanced budget legislation and analysis about how they're going to, that they will get back to balance in 2015, and we don't know what's 15, 16, or 14, 15. So, but that's that was a key measure. There are other measures. They signal other initiatives around consumer agendas and trade agendas, which will be interesting as well, and there will always be some surprises.
The idea of getting back to balance with this budget, I guess, first of all, because it has been raised, do you think there's a need to get back to budget as quickly as possible? You know, I guess the flip side argument is that you could be sort of reining in spending too fast, getting back to budget too fast, getting back to balance too fast. You know, is that something you think needs to be a priority fiscally? Like, setting aside the political considerations, is that a key fiscal consideration?
Well, I think actually setting a fiscal target, which I like. I like when governments have fiscal targets. I don't necessarily believe. I think it's very hard to legislate a fiscal target because, you know, we just don't know what's going to happen to the economy, and we struggle even trying to understand what's happening to the economy as we look out the window. But I think governments need budget constraints. But I think that is a political action. I think there are all kinds of trade-offs that when the Prime Minister and the Finance Minister, when they sit down and they say, I want balance in 2015, like we hope they get briefed on, you know, what's the state of the economy now? Where are the current trends? Is the economy close to potential? If we, you know, if we put the brakes on spending right now, and, you know, in the context of a world economy that's still a little bit fragile and not necessarily self-sustaining, that's still depending on really accommodative monetary policy to grow. In a Canadian economy where our growth rates are declining, like if you look at year-to-year growth rates, we're, you know, hovering around 2%, which is not great because the economy is still operating well below its potential and the unemployment rate is around 7%. It should be lower than that. So then, yeah, you want to know that they've had this discussion and that they're using, you know, the analysis that would come from Department of Finance or the Parliamentary Budget Office. But they make a decision. So there's trade-offs. And, you know, and so if they say we want to get to balance even before the economy gets back to potential, you know, they want to create, you know, they're in a structural deficit now. They want to create something called a structural surplus. They want to have that room to maneuver. They should be honest with that decision and, you know, saying we're going to, you know, we will sacrifice now a little bit and we'll put the squeeze on spending, and it will cost us some jobs and some output in the Canadian economy, but we will be in a better position in 2015.
This became an issue when you were parliamentary budget officer. It's still basically an issue. The amount of disclosure that we have, or that the government has in terms of what they're doing, in terms of how they're getting back to balance, in terms of what they're cutting, does the budget document go far enough disclosure-wise? And you know, what would need to be improved about that document to give us a better understanding of sort of how the books are being balanced?
I think, you know, from the point of view, like we've noticed even in recent budgets where there hasn't been a lot of significant measures because we've been mostly in austerity mode, that they're very thick documents and they become big communication documents for the government to say this is what we've done in the past and we're going to continue to do this. So they're getting bigger and bigger, and yet when I look at the measures going to the front and back, there's actually less and less measures. So. But I think from the point of view of somebody that's worried about transparency and accountability, that Parliament has what it needs to, you know, hold the government to account so that we have good debates, then I think it's the other documents that have become, you know, then become less useful. And I worry about that. So we never, again, we're in a world where the government is committed to freeze direct program spending for 5 years after it's been growing at 6% a year or better for the past 10 years. So, and we know, just like from last week, we saw veterans offices being consolidated. But these issues are not just, you know, veterans affairs issues. They're definitely, we don't know what's going on in Food Inspection Agency. We don't know what's going on in the Coast Guard. We don't know what's going on borders, because we don't get that kind of debate in terms of here's what the cuts, here's where they're going to happen, and here's how we're going to manage service levels. So I think the budget document from a transparency perspective probably goes far enough, maybe almost too much. It's become such a heavy communications document.
So is in a sense then, as much as we make a big deal out of Budget Day, with a fair amount of pageantry and coverage and everything else, does the real work sort of begin after that in terms of both Parliament and the Parliamentary Budget Officer and sort of, you know, outside agencies, you know, possibly such as yourself, sort of looking at what that document means? Like, do we sort of need to extend the budget conversation beyond Budget Day to a certain degree?
Oh, absolutely. That's a really good point. I mean, there's lots of work goes on before Budget Day that is perhaps almost too secretive within the executive. I mean, that involves, you know, Finance Department and the Privy Council Office, you know, supporting the Prime Minister and the Finance Minister, and then working with other departments to make sure they're ready to announce on Budget Day measures. So the executive, that's a lot of work that takes place over the fall and into the winter, and again next week on Tuesday we'll see the results of that work. But absolutely, then we'll have a debate in Parliament, and then then the process shifts to kind of department by department, the important work that gets done in standing committees to make sure that we're delivering good programs and services. But budgets as well. I mean, there's some we've had times. I recall like in 2009, that late January budget where we announced a massive stimulus program. We did not see the world recession coming. And so we found ourselves, the economy, in almost in free fall. We needed a major stimulus package. A huge amount of work took place, behind the scenes, with the finance department and other departments to develop a stimulus package. And it was a major budget. And also Parliament got involved on a quarter-to-quarter basis, sort of tracking the implementation of it. But that was a budget was in my lifetime, really, in the last, 30 years, that kind of really stood out. And actually, probably the government and Parliament did a great job with that stimulus program overall.
That was former Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page.
Coming up, charges are laid in the Senate expense scandal, and we talk Mayor Rob Ford with the author of Crazy Town, Toronto Star reporter Robin Doolittle. This week, we saw a major development in the Senate expense scandal as the Assistant Commissioner of the RCMP's National Division, Gilles Michaud, announced the first charges in this investigation.
The RCMP has proceeded to charge Monsieur Brazeau and Mr. Arb with one count each of breach of trust and fraud under Sections 122 and 380 of the Criminal Code. Both Mr. Brazeau and Mr. Arb will be appearing in court at a later date. I can assure you that we continue our work on other significant files. RCMP investigators continue to explore multiple leads to ascertain all the facts and collect the evidence in support of these facts. We will update Canadians when our work is completed.
Keeping with the Senate, last week Liberal leader Justin Trudeau kicked all 32 senators out of his caucus. And nobody was more caught off guard than the Liberal leader in the upper chamber, Senator James Cowan. A week later, Cowan sat down with Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes to talk about how his Senate Liberal team is adjusting after being set adrift by Trudeau.
You come to Ottawa in 2005, have I got that right?
That's right.
You're already an established, respected figure in your hometown. I know from talking to some people about you, you were known for both your law career, your philanthropic activities, and as a well-known Liberal kind of partisan in the region. Given the way the Senate has evolved during the years that you've been here and what's happened most recently, do you ever think, what did I get myself in for? Why did I come here?
I think the honest answer is that I had made a decision that I wanted to do something different. I practiced law full-time for 40-plus years, enjoyed it, but I wanted to do something. I wanted to change. So I was looking around to do something else. When this opportunity came up and the Prime Minister Martin spoke to me about it, I thought about it and I thought, well, this is a really interesting thing for me to do. I've always been interested in public service. The opportunity came to come up here and I jumped at it.
Senator, over the years that I've covered politics here in Ottawa, it seems to me that when, not just in the most recent heated discussion with the Senate, but in much more routine eras, when people have said critical things about the Senate, senators I've known whom I've respected have almost always come back with the same response. Look at the good work that's going on. They'll point to a report, a particular senator's preoccupation with some worthy cause, and say to me, this is what it's about. And to me, there's always been a dislocation between that side of the Senate and the fact of the two things that have been highlighted recently, and they would be, I guess, patronage and partisanship. The fact is, you guys come here because the Prime Minister of the day liked you for some reason, not because you were elected, not because there was some kind of vetting process. Can you speak to that? You told me some months ago that you thought there should be a different type of selection process.
You know, what I've suggested is that, first of all, I'm not sure that going to an elected Senate is the right way to do it, and we can talk about that at some point. But assuming we continue with an appointed Senate, we can do a lot to improve the appointment process. Right. I mean, most people who are appointed here, I think, are quality people. I think they really are. They want it, they all do their jobs differently, their own way. They come from different backgrounds. You wouldn't want to fill the Senate with, you know, 105 lawyers or journalists or accountants or former elected politicians, or it just wouldn't work. Women or men, or it just wouldn't work. So you need a variety, and appointment gives you the ability to make sure. For instance, there's a higher percentage of women in the Senate than in any elected body, I think, in Canada. Now, what you could do, and my suggestion, and I guess this goes back to my, you know, to my time as a lawyer, is, as you know, over the last 20 years, so a system has been developed, not by constitution, but by practice, which requires, if you want to be a federally appointed judge, and I think in most provinces there's a similar system in place, you apply, you fill in an application, and your application is vetted by a panel which consists of lawyers, judges, some people from who are not either lawyers or judges, and you're either deemed qualified or unqualified. And then that list is provided to the Minister of Justice, and the Minister of Justice would pick from a list of qualified people. The perception, and perhaps even the reality, is that our judiciary is better off as a result of that. I mean, are our courts better now than they were? I don't know the answer to that. But the perception is that they are. Yeah. And the perception is that that's a better system than, say, election, as they have in the U.S., or appointment without any vetting process, as we used to have.
For Canadians who aren't following every twist in this, let me ask you to check off a couple of things. I suspect I know your answers to some of this. Do you think there's any chance the Senate could be abolished?
You know, who am I to judge what the Supreme Court of Canada is going to say? But I've read the briefs of all of the provinces, and I've listened to a lot of and read a lot of expert opinion, and the opinion that I think the overwhelming opinion is that to do that, you would require not only a resolution of Parliament, the House and the Senate, which the government could probably get now since they control both houses, but you need the consent of all 10 provinces. And I think it's unlikely that you would get 10 provinces to agree on anything, much less Senate reform.
Okay, let's
or Senate abolition. Senate abolition.
Do you think we could end up with an elected Senate of some form?
Most opinion that I've heard is that that would require the support of 7 provinces representing 50% of the population.
But if you had to think about 3 more years in this body, what kinds of things do you want to devote yourself to?
Well, I think that Mr. Trudeau has handed us a real challenge. And we've had a week now to kind of absorb it and try to get our heads around it and figure out how we're going to move forward. And I, without sort of revealing any caucus secrets, I think it's fair to say that there was some sort of confusion, dismay, bewilderment a week ago. We got through that last Wednesday, and we met again on Thursday and said, well, we need obviously to talk about, everybody's got some views about what's happened, and it's important that we share those views. But then we need to think about where we're going to go from here. And we've made some very significant progress. And I'm delighted that where we've come, and I don't know where we'll end up, but I think we've made very significant progress, and I think there's some exciting times ahead for us.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes talking with Senate Liberal Leader James Cowan.
Coming up, question period in review and our chat with Toronto Star reporter Robin Doolittle about Mayor Rob Ford and her book, Crazy Town. Over the last year, there is only one scandal that has captured the attention of Canadians more than the Senate, and that scandal is Rob Ford.
Robin Doolittle is the Toronto Star reporter who helped break the story about the Toronto mayor's drug use, and she now has a new book chronicling the Rob Ford story called Crazy Town. On a phone while in a cab in Toronto, Doolittle speaks with McLean's columnist Emma Tidal.
So I wanted to start by asking you about one of the biggest revelations in your book, which I just finished. Which is about Rob Ford's wife, Renata.
Right.
And the recorded conversation she had with her, with a friend who was a drug addict at one point. And she was seeking advice from him about her husband, who was a drug addict, who had just been elected at the time, or an alleged drug addict. And it seemed for a long time like there was this unwritten rule in the press against reporting extensively on Ford's wife in particular and his kids, and you kind of broke that rule. And I just want to know if you think you've sort of done Canadian journalism a favor by breaking that rule. That was the toughest part of the book for me, was grappling with that very issue with Rob Ford's wife Renata, but with also with his sister Kathy and his brother Randy and his mother, because they are not elected officials and they didn't ask to be in the spotlight. In the end, I decided that I would only include details that I thought were really pertinent to his information, were really pertinent to kind of filling out his story and this whole saga. With the Renata tape, to me, the public interest was just so clear. One, she's discussing his drug use right after he's been elected. The foreshadowing is just unbelievable. She's saying, you know, we're public officials now. Everyone's going to be watching us, and you could ruin your whole life. And he says, well, I'll give up the pills, but I'm not going to give up the blow. Secondly, the conversation was being tape recorded, unbeknownst to her. And this is why you have to keep a check on your personal when you're in public life, especially when it comes to elements of criminality, because you do open yourself up to blackmail. Mm-hmm. And we, from police wiretaps, it certainly looks like the mayor may have been being blackmailed when it came to the crack video.
And how did you come to the conclusion that Ford had been using drugs since 2006?
I don't even think that's really what that's not what I was trying to say. I was trying to say that seems to be the moment when he went off the rails.
Okay.
Like when it started becoming, and I don't actually have the book in front of me, and I probably should reread that because I get constantly asked about it. I found evidence of hard drug use, according to people in his life, dating back to his 20s. Mm-hmm. Like cocaine was the first time I heard about that when he was in his 20s. And he's always had this kind of drugs and alcohol in his life. Obviously, he was arrested for marijuana possession and drunk driving in 1999 in the States. But in 2006, when his father died, that seems to be the moment when his personal life sort of started spiraling out of control. And I certainly had sources indicate to me that was when they were kind of started talking about crack use.
I said that when you first saw the video, obviously your editors told you it had to be a total secret. You couldn't tell any colleagues or your friends or family. What was it like keeping that secret for such a long time? Did your friends or family suspect that you had it? Could you say to them, there's the secret, I can't tell you, but you'll know later? Or was it just like they thought you were being a total weirdo?
So my friends knew that I was doing something sport-related, but never really asked. They knew I couldn't talk about it. What was more difficult is you want to say to people like, oh my God, this is what I saw. Like, what do you think? And like kind of decompress and unpack this. Like, what could this mean? You have so many things to what you're thinking about it. And I just wasn't able to. And that was really difficult.
Yeah. The day that you saw it, that you saw the video thing, and you weren't allowed to write any notes, right? You weren't allowed to take notes.
Right.
And so how did that work? Like when you and Kevin went into the cart, would you decide beforehand, like, I'll remember everything that's said on the tape and you remember how everything looks? Or do you just sort of go in, watch the tape, and then sort of try and regurgitate everything you remember onto paper immediately after?
Well, we didn't really have a conversation about it. We were in the car and then this guy pulled up and said, leave your bags. Like they didn't say we couldn't take notes beforehand. So it was kind of one of those, like, we're leaving our bags, we're getting in the car. And yeah, we watched it three times. It's not a long video, but the problem, you know, I spend a lot of time trying to remember things. So, like, I think I have a pretty good memory. The problem with trying to follow the tape and remember what was going on is that a lot of his words didn't connect to one another. I just kept repeating in my head over and over again things that I thought that he said. And then we got back into our own car and just kind of silently wrote things down and then compared notes after that.
When the story broke out, one of the first things I noticed online is that you were facing a lot of unwarranted criticism and, I thought, sexism. Recently, some Zoe Barnes comparisons. Does that kind of thing surprise you and piss you off at all? it really pisses me off, exclamation point, underline. But it doesn't necessarily surprise me. I was a little taken aback by some of the more sexist stuff, especially from people that, not anonymous people, like that people were so willing to kind of attach their names to some of the comments. That was interesting. And yeah, the Zoe Barnes character, while I am a fan of House of Cards, has done a great disservice to young female journalists, because the crazy thing for me is when people tell me, oh, you're just like Zoe Barnes, as a compliment. Like, a lot of people really do think it's a compliment, and it's like, no, I mean, she's pretty, so that's great, thanks, but like, she sleeps with people to get her stories, and she's overly ambitious. Not that ambition is bad or anything, but she seems willing to compromise her integrity to get ahead, and that is absolutely not what I'm about.
So where do you go from here? Like, you're so much a part of this story. Are you going to continue to chase forward in the same way?
I have no idea. I'd like to cover the election, I think, and kind of see how this tale ends, at least that this part of the tale. And after that, I think I'd like to do something else. Only, but that's not even like anything other than I've been on this beat for four or five years now.
Are you bored of Rob Ford a little bit?
I'm bored of chasing him to the bathroom and standing outside the elevator when he gets off and all of those things. Yeah, like I hate chasing scrums. That's my like one thing that I don't know if it's a great use of time. But with Rob, it's kind of required, because he does, you know, like he made the crack confession. He's got off the elevator and said, I smoke crack. And so you really kind of have to be there for those moments. But no, I think that one thing with the book that I try to illustrate is, while this is very funny for a lot of people, especially outside of Toronto, you know, you see videos of him miming drunk driving, and he's kind of funny to laugh at, and it's this a YouTube sensation in the making. There's a really, like, he is the mayor of this city. This is serious, and this is, at some point, we all have to kind of take a step back and go, wait a minute, this guy has a say in the police budget. Like, this guy's representing our city. This guy is hanging out with gang members who are smuggling drugs into the city and guns into the city. He's opening himself up to blackmail. This is really bad. And I think we'll need to take a moment and consider the severity of the situation.
Do you think he'll be charged?
I have no idea. I get asked that all the time, and I have no idea, and I wouldn't want to speculate. What we know for sure is that the police are obviously still paying attention to him, and we can see from the last two incidents at State Queen and then in Vancouver that he has still not gotten control of his personal life.
Once again, that was Maclean's columnist Emma Tytle speaking with Toronto Star reporter and author Robin Doolittle about her new book on Mayor Rob Ford.
Now, before we go, we need to update you on all the action this week in the House of Commons. Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on Macleans.ca, joins us for Question Period in Review.
Pierre Poilievre is trying to boldly reshape Canadian elections. Sounds easy, right? Yeah, right. On Monday, before Poilievre even tabled the bill, NDP MP Craig Scott accused the minister of drafting the legislation without consulting Elections Canada. Poilievre disagreed.
I did meet with the CEO of Elections Canada some time ago, and we had a terrific and a very long meeting, at which I listened carefully to all of his ideas. The Fair Elections Act will keep everyday citizens in charge of democracy by putting special interests on the sidelines and rule breakers out of the game altogether. It will give law enforcement sharper teeth, a longer reach, and a freer hand. And it will crack down on, it will close loopholes to big money in politics.
The next day, Poilievre came out firing.
Well, certainly the wrong way to start discussions is to do what that member did, which is to walk out and announce his opposition to a bill that he admitted that he hadn't even read. But as for consultations, I did meet with the chief electoral officer on August 22nd for about an hour, listened carefully to all of his thoughts until he had nothing more to add. I told him if he thought of anything, he could call me at any time. I've since read his reports, studied his testimony before committee, and implemented 38 of his recommendations in the Fair Elections Act.
But the NDP didn't give up. Chris Charlton, an MP from Hamilton, accused the government of making it harder for certain Canadians to get to the polls.
Elections Canada has been working to get people without fixed addresses registered and voting. They've been doing outreach to young people and engaging First Nations communities to increase voter turnout. But the Conservatives' new bill slams the door on all of that very important work. The minister claims his bill targets special interests, but in reality, it reduces Elections Canada's powers and removes its ability to do public education. Why? Does the minister believe Elections Canada is now a special interest?
On Thursday, the NDP stuck with electoral reform for much of question period, but Mulcair also snapped at Treasury Board President Tony Clement's, let's say, fragile conversation with federal unions about sick leave.
The president of the Treasury Board has made some alarming claims about rampant abuse of sick days in the public service. The minister has painted the public servants as scammers, claiming 20% more sick days than they're allowed. The only problem is, it's not true. The Parliamentary Budget Officer has run the numbers and confirms that the minister misled Canadians and misled this House. Does the minister have the courage to simply stand in this House and apologize to the thousands of public servants he has smeared?
Clement claimed the PBO's numbers actually backed up his own, but the NDP was not listening. And as public servants gear up for high-stakes bargaining coming later this year, the NDP is certainly spoiling for a fight.
Thanks to Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on Macleans.ca. That's it for this week's episode.
Don't forget, on Wednesday, Macleans is hosting a post-budget breakfast with former Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page, Ailish Campbell with the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, and Laval University economist Stephen Gordon. Head to Macleans.ca for the details.
Thanks once again to former Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page, the Minister of State for Democratic Reform Pierre Poilievre, Minister of State for Finance Kevin Sorensen, the Leader of the Senate Liberals James Cowan, and Toronto Star reporter Robin Doolittle. For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.